Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Weiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of the Middle Ground.
Good evening, everyone. This is Michael Charney. Welcome to the Middle Ground. I'm joined, as always, with my co-host Eric Weiler, who is on the road, and I'll bring him in a little while. We're here tonight to talk about the verdict, and the word apparently comes with a capital V. It seems it's on everybody's mind. There was a meme floating around Facebook today, and I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of it was that, you know, thanks to Facebook, everybody got a law degree in the last couple of days, and everybody's become an expert on this case, apparently. There seems to be very few who are accepting of anything, at least from what I've seen, that's not either black or white in this. And as many of you who listen to this show know or read my blog know, I often find myself in a much grayer area, and some people beat me up about that a bit for not coming down on one side or another, or being a bit wishy-washy or being a fence sitter. But I think this is another one of those situations where we just will never really, really know. And I'm inviting people to talk tonight about different perspectives on the verdict, what they think of it, and particularly why they think what they think of it. I think that's more interesting to me in a lot of ways, is how we come to the conclusions that we come to. Eric, who we'll talk to in a few minutes, was at a Tea Party rally today and listened to a couple of speeches regarding the verdict. But it's interesting. No matter where you look, it's everywhere. I mean, you certainly can't escape it. On our own Coffee Party page today and yesterday, it was just post after post. I blogged about it today. I posted a couple times about it today, as have others. I noticed some interesting things. Some people refer to it as the Zimmerman verdict, and some people refer to it as the Trayvon Martin case, and it's kind of telling to me who sort of leads with which name. I myself have been calling it the Zimmerman case because he's the one who's on trial. But it is a kind of interesting thing, even in sort of the words that we choose. So we're going to talk about that. A quick note of apology. We did originally tell you last week that we were going to continue our discussion on democracy, and in particular to talk a bit tonight about how our attitude in foreign policy affects our views on democracy and particularly some of the things that are going on in the Middle East. We're going to pen that for another show because clearly we're dealing with the news of the day here, and it's the thing that's on everybody's mind. So it's the Middle Ground with Eric Weiler and Michael Charney. Of course, this is your show more than it is ours. Our call-in number is 646-929-2495. We're anxious to hear what you think about the verdict, and in particular, as I said, why you think what you think, how you sort of came to the conclusions that you came to about whether this was a good verdict, not a good verdict, whether it was right, whether it was wrong. Please call in and share. Again, 646-929-2495. And if you'd like to join the show, it is a caller-led show, as much as we can possibly make it. Please press 1, and then we'll know that you're in queue. I will identify you most likely by area code. So when you listen up for your area code, we all already have a couple people in queue. But first, let me, as always, welcome. I shouldn't say as always because I'm just recently back from hiatus. But going forward, more often than not, welcome my co-host Eric Weiler, who is still in North Carolina, but you're on the road, I guess now, literally on the road in a car, right? Between where and where?
We are between Raleigh and Durham, and we stopped, so I'm in a car, and Annabelle and Emily, who's filming with us, are stocking up on drinks because we were just in the worst heat you've ever. It was awful. But we did film it's a Tea Party rally. It was Americans for Prosperity and the North Carolina versions of Koch brothers type of stuff, Art Pope and his organization. There were quite a few Republican state legislators there. I mean, they couldn't even all fit on the stage. And there were a respectable number of activists there. And the purpose of the rally was to show that, I guess you could say, progressives are not the only people who can have a rally, and that Democratic members of the General Assembly are not the only ones with support. But because it did come on the heels of the Trayvon Martin verdict, it was definitely in the air, and particularly they had two African-American speakers, and one of them spoke about that case at length, and it was I won't say fire and brimstone, but it was fiery, and it got the crowd revved up more than any other issue: taxes, abortion, guns, you know, or just being, you know, despairing of the Moral Monday protests. This was the thing that people were most passionate about. And afterwards, we interviewed some people, and I learned some things. You know, some of them had really, really studied the case. They were all white men, probably 50 and over. And one of them in particular, I asked if he felt a personal sense of hurt. Did he feel wounded that people were attempting to make this case all about race and racism and white racism? And we talked some about that. So I could share some of that, you know, after we take a few calls. But I want to say for myself, and many of you have read my blog, which is actually a vlog, because I happened to be at a birthday party that was attended by a lot of African Americans when the verdict was announced on Saturday night, and Annabelle and I ran for the cameras, and we filmed about 4 hours of really interesting stuff, not just venting, but also strategizing. People saying, well, what do we do now? What do we do next? So...
I want to ask you about that. That's interesting,
yeah,
because
yeah.
Why do you think this case promotes a what do we do next? Why do you think people were reacting that way?
Well, a lot of these people, first of all, I think the African-American perspective, and this wasn't a, this was a multi-ethnic party, probably half white and half black, and the two people whose party it was are both white. But a lot of African Americans attended, and you know, there were some, you know, people who you know, are pretty well known in the Moral Monday movement who were there. And you know, I'd have to go back and look at the footage, because I've filmed, you know, another 20 hours since then. But some of the people with more of a historical mindset were looking at this not necessarily that is a legal case, although they felt that the legal case was, you know, they didn't agree with the verdict. They were looking at this as a cultural event. And they said that Rosa Parks said in interviews that when she summoned the courage to stay seated on that bus where she was seated, she was thinking of Emmett Till. And they said that a lot of the political courage that supported the Montgomery bus boycotts were inspired by Emmett Till. And so people, after about 3 hours of talking about other things that, you know, probably more of our callers will talk about, they started to talk about, I wonder what good could come out of this. I wonder if perhaps this could, you know, Trayvon may not have justice, but he could have a legacy of helping to inspire America to overcome some of the racial divisions and become one people.
Yeah, I find that interesting because, you know, it's a case, and this is going to sound somewhat callous, but I have a hard time hanging my hat on the importance of this case culturally. I was doing a little research today, and I blogged about, I mentioned this in my blog today, about roughly a month after the incident, the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman shooting, killing, to be, you know, those are facts. About a month after that, a young white man in Alabama, I believe it was Alabama, Jackson, Mississippi, was sentenced to life in prison for having run over a 47-year-old black man in a parking lot. And this was malicious. This was, as the facts of the case came out, it came as close to any definition of a hate crime as I've ever heard. You know, he actually went out looking for a black man to hassle. And he was convicted of murder and got actually a double life sentence for it. There were some other things going on there as well. That wasn't a cultural case. I mean, very, very few people. I haven't talked to anyone who has heard of that case. And, you know, I sort of wonder what role the media and the state of Florida and the where we are with things like even what impacts something like the Connecticut massacre, Sandy Hook, had, because gun control is now top of mind and stand your ground laws have become news, even though they're not brand new either. Whether or not this isn't a confluence of events, but this particular case does not, in my mind, create this aura of, you know, it's open season on African Americans, or it's open season on anyone, or that there's some great cultural event that has just occurred that is different from the probably hundreds, if not thousands, of similar instances in, you know, a race that may or may not have been race related that have happened in the interim. I just don't understand why this case. I'm curious why you think, or why they thought that this case was the case that would have such cultural impact.
Well, it's on TV so much as having that impact. We just have to acknowledge that, but I think that it's not so much these are the two factors for, I think, the African-American perspective. Or I don't want to say that. I'd say it's the perspective of this fusion of many races in North Carolina that is powering the Moral Monday movement. Okay, so this is the people we talked to yesterday, and these are the two issues, and I'm going to stay away from the verdict, but I'll just tell you right now, I don't feel it was a miscarriage of justice with the verdict. Okay, but that's just me with the little bit of headline news and CNN that I've watched. But as far as how did we get to a situation where this 17-year-old child walking innocently with Skittles and iced tea is confronted and a person with a gun shoots him in the heart, well, there was racial profiling. And I don't think it means that George Zimmerman is a racist. I think it means that we have a cultural phenomenon that's hundreds of years old, and it is perpetuated in things like media, where we see a young black man as a threat, as a potential criminal. And it's not George Zimmerman's fault, with no training whatsoever in law enforcement, with really no business being in any kind of physical confrontation at all, or any kind of serious business at all. He just drew upon the kind of stereotypes that many people would, if they're honest, have developed probably from watching TV, if not in some cases from actual experience, that, you know, they may have encountered somebody who was aggressive, or someone who, I was once held up with a shotgun, and when I told my dad about it afterwards, he asked of the race of the person who held me up, and I asked him why, what does it matter, first, but then I told him that the person, was black, and so you can, you can develop these kinds of, I think it's natural. You can develop these prejudices. The problem is that when these prejudices are used in decisions that are life and death, and certainly racial profiling, when law enforcement does it, and if we're going to make every wannabe loser into law enforcement now with guns everywhere and stand your ground laws to defend, to protect you in case you end up shooting someone, Well, racial profiling is an even worse problem than it was, because now you're talking about, and this is what I said in my blog, it's not just an inconvenience to be racially profiled and apprehended by someone with a gun. You're being put in a dangerous situation where something will go horribly, horribly wrong, and it's a situation that you're in because of the color of your skin, and another person is not going to be in that situation. So I think it is a cultural thing. It's emblematic. And, you know, the historian Tim Tyson, who wrote the book, Blood Done Sign My Name, was later made into a movie about a case that many people say was a lynching in Oxford, North Carolina, in the 70s. What he said is that these cases, you know, there's all kinds of crazy cases out there. It's not really the circumstances of the cases that make them cultural phenomenon. It's what is happening in history at the time that makes it strike a nerve. And I think that, you know, it is a very delicate time for our country when it comes to race. And the last point I'll make is, you know, before this verdict, I talked to Tim Tyson about his book, Blood Done Sign My Name. And what happened basically is these three men, a man and his two sons, beat and then shot a black man to death, a veteran who'd returned from Vietnam, because he had apparently smiled at a man's wife, at one of the son's wife. And then they were acquitted by an all-white jury. And what Tim Tyson said is that it wasn't a lynching, but it became a lynching in the way it was handled in the justice system, because the people of Oxford, Mississippi, all the people who had power, made sure that these men were not convicted. And it was basically an implementation of white supremacy. It's basically an expression of white supremacy, because what it says to whites and blacks alike is that there are two classes here, and justice is for one of those classes, and there is no justice for the other, especially if those two races are at odds. And you better remember that, you know, and that basically this is directed at African-American men, that you basically need to take a back seat, and if you're walking down the street and somebody's looking at you, you better look down. And if somebody's mad at you for smiling, you better run. Don't dare defend yourself, because the only people who are allowed to defend themselves are white people, and our justice system will see to it. And to me, when tons of money poured in to defend George Zimmerman, when all we really knew is that he'd shot a 17-year-old kid who had Skittles in his pocket, that's all we knew at the time, that millions of dollars or whatever it was, hundreds of thousands of dollars rolled in, that reminded me of, well, I can't say it reminded me because it happened first, but that smacks to me of sort of that after-the-fact lynching kind of scenario where people, in some way, I think people prefer that old South system of justice, and they're uncomfortable with things changing, and that this verdict, you know, like I said, I don't think it was a miscarriage of justice, but I think some people were rooting one way or the other based on historical and cultural phenomenon that had nothing to do with the particulars of the case.
I would agree with you. There was a really, and I also, by the way, don't think it was a miscarriage of justice, but I'm not arguing that racial profiling didn't occur, although I think that's a pretty loaded term these days. What I would say is I would not argue that George Zimmerman reacted, at least in part, because Trayvon Martin was an African American. I wouldn't question that. I don't know it, but I wouldn't question that. There's a difference, though, between being prejudiced and being a racist. I think to some degree we're all prejudiced, and I think we'd be naive not to admit that to ourselves. The difference between being prejudiced and being racist is racists don't know how to overcome their prejudice. So I absolutely think that was a factor. I also think, though, coming back to this idea of the machinery, whatever machinery it was, including, as you pointed out, I think money that poured in, it'd be interesting to know whether that money poured in first or later, after the marketing circus began. So, for example, you expressed twice, and then we've got a few people calling, but I just want to mention a little bit about how seemingly innocuous and yet it's sneaky the way the marketing creeps up on you. You mentioned twice the Skittles and the iced tea. I was reading a number, and those are clearly marketing images. We were sold the Skittles. We were sold the iced tea. There's no question about that. You know, they weren't these incredibly pertinent facts of the case that he happened to be holding Skittles. At the same time, what we didn't hear, and I did a little research today on a few of the facts, and I'm no expert here, we didn't hear that that Trayvon Martin was walking between the houses. He wasn't sticking to the sidewalks. We conveniently forgot that, some people brought it up and were pushed back on, that this was a community that had very recently undergone some break-ins. And so while I don't discount anything that you said in terms of certainly the prejudice involved and the fact that his race was a factor, there's no question in my mind that equally strong is the story that we were sold. And maybe that story, the Skittles and iced tea story, is a counter story to the money being poured in to defend Zimmerman. And there was a great article in Salon, I think it was yesterday, that talked about, had this not been a media circus, the verdict very well could have gone, it may never even have gone to trial, although he may never have been charged either. So there are so many things about this that I'm not sure whether the cultural moment came before or whether the cultural moment is a marketing creation. In my mind, I don't know that I'll ever know, and I've been pretty uncomfortable and taken to task by quite a few people who are absolutely sure about it. So, anyway, on that note, let's take a couple calls. I'm sure that there are people chomping at the bit to talk about this. We've got a few people in queue. We're going to go to 661, then 781. Then 270, then 518. So we appreciate your patience as we go through these calls. First, we'll go to area code 661. Welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, this is D.R. Tucker calling from Boston.
Oh, hi, D.R. How are you? Thank you for calling in. I was actually going to send you an email and ask you if you would.
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Thanks, D.R.
Sure.
What's on your mind, dear?
Just a couple of observations. First of all, I can't say that the result of the trial was a surprise, because I'd been listening to a number of different analysts basically talking about, you know, how the prosecution wasn't really making its case under Florida law. I go back to the to some of the coverage the year before, you know, in 2012, right after the incident occurred, where people pointed out at that time that under the way Florida law was structured, it was probably unlikely that there would be a conviction. Now, having said that, I'm a bit fascinated by one of the particular aspects of this case that I think has gone a bit under the radar, and if you're a Twitter obsessive as I am, it's something you pick up on. There seems to have been some sort of dispute or disconnect or feud, or however you want to call it, between shall we say, conservatives and Republicans who support Zimmerman and think Zimmerman got railroaded, and conservatives and Republicans, particularly African-American conservatives and Republicans, who have been trying to make the argument that regardless of how one feels about Zimmerman's legal guilt, there is an issue of profiling that does occur in society and that it is a problem. And there are a couple of people on Twitter in particular, I won't name them, but there are a couple of individuals in particular who've been really having, you know, they've been basically getting torn to shreds because they've been trying to make the argument that, you know, there is still a problem in terms of people being viewed according to old stereotypes, and the counter argument from the people with whom they're feuding on Twitter is basically saying, you know, aren't those stereotypes based in, you know, criminal statistics? And they make the counter argument that, you know, you cannot take statistics and apply them to individuals, to use the obvious corollary, you know, just because there are high-profile cases of Catholic priests molesting children, that does not give one the right to assume that every person who is a Catholic priest is abusing children. So there's been this sort of fascinating discussion basically between people who are saying, you know, let's talk about profiling, and people who are saying profiling isn't really a problem, and if you claim that profiling is still a problem, you're just being politically correct. And I find that one of the fascinating tangents about the aftermath of Zimmerman's acquittal.
Do you think that's perhaps covering something else? I mean, I guess some things to me are just obvious, and maybe I'm naive, or maybe I'm just stubborn. They're obvious to me, but not to other people. The idea that we don't have a tendency, that any human being doesn't have a tendency to fall into certain traps about people of other races. And I'm trying to stay away from the phrase racial profiling, because I think racial profiling has, you know, lots of baggage associated with it in a different way. But, you know, I remember as a kid, and when I say kid, 12, 13 years old, and I lived in a mixed race neighborhood. And this is the early 70s now, or the mid 70s, and I remember crossing the street to be on the side of the street where the white kids were. If I was walking down the street, okay, and there were black kids that I didn't know coming down the street toward me, I would sometimes cross the street to where the white kids were. And there were several things that were telling about that. One, there were white kids on one side and black kids on the other. I'm using the word black intentionally because that was the reference then. And also there was a certain level of experience. I had had problems, other friends. I was sort of an underweight, gangly Jewish kid who was just ripe for being beat up by people all the time. And so those kinds of things build in, and as I said earlier, I don't think those prejudices go away. I think the ability to overcome those prejudices is what makes the difference between most of us and those people who we would call racist today. I don't see this as news that there are really people who are denying that this is still part of our culture. And you're saying that people are. Do you think it's covering up something else? Why do people? I don't understand how people can really believe that, I guess.
In other words, how can people deny that there is such a thing as stereotypes again?
Not even stereotypes, but stereotypes in which we behave in a certain negative way, and have to fight to overcome them.
Well, the dispute that's been happening on Twitter, it involves people who are saying, you know, essentially that people who are, you know, law-abiding African-Americans who are concerned about profiling, in essence, need to get over it, basically. And the other side of the argument is that, you know, it's not something that needs to be gotten over. It needs to be addressed in the sense that, you know, people can make assumptions about others, but when those assumptions can have fatal consequences, or at least, you know, profoundly negative legal consequences, then it becomes quite a different story. What I notice is a lot of and I'm particularly honing in on this roster of African American Republicans who are just stunned by the fact that there are non African American Republicans who are not just saying that, you know, that Zimmerman, you know, should have been acquitted based on Florida law, but who are actively pro Zimmerman and promoting Zimmerman as a hero. And the dispute is that basically the African American Republicans are arguing, how can you say the guy was a hero when he made a number of mistakes? No one is saying that Trayvon Martin was an angel or never made any sort of mistake himself, just that the amount of mistakes Zimmerman made or the amount of questionable decisions Zimmerman made are on such a significant level that holding the guy up as a hero and basically embracing him as some sort of conservative culture war figure doesn't seem to make any sense. And I think there was one person who pointed out that according to all the media reports, Zimmerman is actually a registered Democrat. So why are some white Republicans embracing a registered Democrat? And what is the motivation for that? Is it simply, you know, some sort of defense of the NRA or defense of the Second Amendment or what? But sort of the blowing off, the perceived blowing off of concerns about law-abiding African-Americans who do have to deal with, you know, things like, you know, people grabbing their purses in the elevator or in a restaurant or being followed in stores or what have you. And the perceived lack of empathy that Zimmerman's supporters have towards that experience.
Yeah, I do. I find it puzzling, mind-boggling in some ways that, you know, what do people need to do, or what is it they need to bury, if that's not too strong a word, in themselves in order to deny, you know, cultural fact, essentially. And this idea of Zimmerman as a hero to me is just absurd, as is the idea of Trayvon as an innocent child, you know, skipping his way home with Skittles and iced tea. I think both of those images are equally ridiculous. And as you point out, there were serious issues, serious mistakes made on both sides. DR, thanks a lot for calling in. If you want to hang around, I'm sure we'll get a chance to get back to you. Probably want to get your reactions to a couple of these other callers as well, but definitely want to let some of these other callers who've been waiting in as well. Thanks for that. By the way, I just before we go to the next call, I want to say that my story about my behavior when I was 12 is not something I'm proud of, and I certainly wouldn't behave and haven't behaved that way as an adult. But I'm sort of trying to be open about the fact that people just kind of react, and unless you get to a point where you are aware of your own reactions and do your best to overcome them. The idea that that there's anybody so pure out there that can cast that first stone or live in that glass house when it comes to feelings about race and stereotyping, I think is just naive. Let's go to area code 781 is our next caller, then 270 and 518 after that. Area code 781, welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Kathleen. I'm from Scituate, Massachusetts.
Hello, Kathleen from Scituate. I believe you've called before. Welcome back.
I have, yeah. Not every time, but once in a while I like to chime in a little. I enjoyed what you wrote today about the case. The chart, I agree, was a little like, what? it kind of confused me.
So, just very quickly, for those who haven't had a chance to look, my blog today included a chart that I got out of the UK Mail online, and it talked about the likelihood in percentage terms of certain cases leading to conviction relative to the race that was involved. So, Kathleen, is I went back to the website and I created a link from that just below or just above that table so that people can get to the original, which I apologize for not doing. But basically, it is all relative to white-on-white homicides, right? So this was the idea was that if it was a white-on-black homicide, you were as the white defendant, you were in general 220%, 2.2 times more likely to be acquitted. If you were in a stand your ground case, 3.6 times more likely to be acquitted. And so the reference, and it wasn't clear on the table, was, you know, as a baseline would be white on white, and the other comparisons were in there for that. So I apologize for the confusion in that table.
Oh, no, not at all. I assumed it was me, actually.
No, it wasn't you. It was I had forgotten to copy in the caption to the table, so it wasn't you. So I linked back out to it.
Well, I did enjoy what you wrote, and you, a number of your thoughts were mine as well. But if I could throw a few things out.
Sure, please.
Okay, well, my first point, and I'm going to be a little maybe more honest than some people might be comfortable with, but I want to make a point as far as the, you know, the prejudiced side of this whole incident. If I were on the subway and there was one other person in the car with me, it wouldn't matter what color they were or even what gender they were. If I'm the if there's only two people in there, I'm going to be nervous. But I guess part of what confuses me is people making generalizations, you know, from sex to race, you know, the way somebody's dressed. It's just a horrible, closed-minded thing that people still judge from the outside. Now, I had read somewhere, oh, I'm sorry, I want to finish my point. I understand the point of, like, if somebody got, was a victim of crime of, committed by somebody of a different race, that that might expand into them having a problem with the whole race. It, you know, if it gets out of control, that it just might blossom into that. But where I kind of want to stand things on their head is that a victim of rape, I'm pretty sure the largest segment of victims would not hold it against all men. You know what I'm saying? It's making those huge umbrella statements or not, well, statements, but also, you know, adopting those as how you feel. They're both just, I don't know. I can't get my brain around this being the way it was in the media. I think initially that's where the racism angle of this was drilled into everybody's heads. See, I looked at it as this law is insane. I didn't look at it, at, you know, the two of them, I didn't look at their races, but the story I heard was that this was like the old South. Take it in your hands to achieve what you see as justice or what you see as the proper way of doing things. Essentially, he committed a homicide. Was it justifiable?
Well, no. Homicide is a legal term, right? So he committed a killing. There's no question about that. But homicide is, you know, there are different kinds of killings, including in this case self-defense, right? Legally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that the term justifiable homicide. You know, I just started thinking of it different ways. And the only way I could see it as justifiable, given the difference in their sizes, if Trayvon was hitting George's head, as they claimed, against the sidewalk, you know, the difference in their sizes. I mean, George Zimmerman's a sturdy guy. I don't understand why he wouldn't have a problem just pushing Trayvon off him and holding him down till the police got there. Instead of, you know, Trayvon didn't have a weapon. He didn't have one. That's outrageous.
We're starting to get a little bit into the specifics, the facts of the case, and you know, the truth is, there's a whole bunch we're never going to know, right?
Right.
Yes, he didn't have a weapon. There's no question about it, but we don't know how the altercation began. We don't know. We do know some things. We know that Zimmerman shouldn't have been where he was.
Mm-hmm.
That he was instructed to stay in. We do know that. And there was an interesting article that I read on NPR where the the head of the National Sheriff's Association, which coordinates neighborhood watches, and they have a set of standards for neighborhood watch behavior. Was pretty clear that Zimmerman violated all of those standards, or many of those standards for neighborhood watch behavior in terms of, what he did in following Trayvon Martin. But once we get past
right.
that, and to DR's point, there's no question that Zimmerman did things he shouldn't have done. But once we get past that, then it all starts to get very fuzzy on exactly what occurred. And all we can do is deal with the facts of the case as they were presented in court.
Right.
I'm interested
right.
in the suppositions that people make about that. I think that I've heard the comparisons to women feeling uncomfortable, people being alone with other people feeling uncomfortable, all of those kinds of situations, and the simple fact is we do make those snap decisions, and the mm-hmm. the thought in my mind that we'll ever not be that way, just in terms of kind of what I've studied in terms of brain structure and the way the brain works and evolutionary neuropsychology and some of that casual reading that I like to do because I'm just strange that way suggests that there's a lot of evolutionary benefit to making snap decisions based on quick glances, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you wait around to see whether that fuzzy, hairy thing in the bushes is or is not a lion, you're much less likely to survive than if you just decide it's probably a lion and you run away.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the kinds of evolutionary and biological reactions that still happen in our brains, and we get these media images and we get these other kinds of historical images. We hear stories from people. We may have had personal experience in our own lives like I have. And those are just not only tough to turn off, but I think fundamentally impossible to turn off, not necessarily impossible to overcome, but impossible to turn off. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's I think this idea that you bring up is, your question about why people judge on appearance, I don't think that's going away anytime soon. I just don't think people will stop judging on appearance. I think it's what they do once they've judged that makes the difference. And from a cultural point of view and a societal point of view, I would love to see us personally attack that, not try to pretend that we can ever change people from making snap judgments based on appearance, but to work on what happens after that. After
mm-hmm.
the brain says, uh-oh, how do we teach people or change society in a way that everybody wants to take a step before they react the way George Zimmerman did? So, anyway, Kathleen, thank you for the call. We've got several other people in queue I want to get to. I appreciate your calling in. And we're going to move on to a couple of other callers. But first, we're just going to take a short break for a second while we grab our thoughts together. If you've been hanging in queue, we appreciate your patience. We'll be with you in just a moment. This is The Middle Ground with Michael Charney and Eric Beiler.
Hello everyone, this is John Cash, host of the Coffee Party Radio Civics Minute. Did you know that the Coffee Party is funded by our listeners and fans, and not by the super PACs, think tanks, or by a super wealthy individual wanting to buy the American way? The Coffee Party USA is powered by the people, and your passion to bring positive change to our country, but we need your help to continue. With just a small donation, you can help us continue bringing Americans together for a dialogue that attempts to bypass the normal partisan rhetoric that is so common today. The Coffee Party USA is striving to bring you original content from editorials, fact-checking, and video documentaries, while also working to bring you the latest information from all of the 535 congressional districts. No matter what party we may belong or what issues that we follow, one thing is always clear. We are all American. Please go to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/donate and donate what you can to help us move our country forward, united with one voice, E Pluribus Unum. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cash. Good day, everyone.
Well, Welcome back. You're listening to The Middle Ground with Michael Charney and co-host Eric Beiler, currently on the road in North Carolina. We are talking tonight about the Zimmerman verdict, the Trayvon Martin case, the Florida justice system, and our reactions to it. We are currently taking calls, so if you'd like to join the show, our number here is 646-929-2495, and if you'd like to be on the show, please just press 1 and we'll know you're in queue. Now, right now we're going to go to area code 270. Area code 270, welcome to The Middle Ground. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Marcel, and I'm calling from Paducah, Kentucky.
Hello, Marcel. How are you?
Hello, Michael. Hi, Eric. How are you?
I believe we just listened to your husband do a voiceover for us.
Yes. Yes, you did.
What's on your mind, Marcel?
It's very interesting hearing everything that everybody has to say. And John and I lived in Sanford for a while. And I guess the whole thing with this case that has struck me is that when he originally contacted 911, he was told not to pursue anything, and he did. And it is what it is, and, well, it isn't what it is, but it's happened, and the trial's over, and it's all done with. But, you know, maybe if he had taken the advice, none of this would have happened. I haven't really followed the trial. I've been working, and I don't know how much of that or if that was even brought up. But
it's been brought up quite a bit. And this NPR interview that I mentioned just a few minutes ago, Chris Tutko, who's the head of the National Sheriff's Association, brought that up. One of the standard rules for neighborhood watches is that they are not supposed to pursue. If they see some sort of activity that they consider suspicious, they're supposed to call it in and step away. And
right.
There's no question that Zimmerman did not do that. That was incredibly poor judgment on his part. The question that always, or the thing about this that has bothered me, Marcel, is the speed with which people are ready to assume his motivations for doing so, that he was aggressive,
yeah,
that he was a stalker, that he was – I saw the phrase that he was a hunter, and this image that he somehow was a predator is no more valid than the possibility that he was just really afraid. And wanted,
yeah,
to keep the guy in sight. We don't know who turned to who first and said what, but there's no question that he violated what's considered a basic principle. And for those of you who don't know, and I didn't until just a couple of hours before the show, there is, neighborhood watches, while they do, you know, they can just pop up, they are both regionally and national oversight organizations for this. There are some 25,000 registered neighborhood watches in the United States, although some estimates would suggest that there are at least four or five times as many more that are unregistered. But in Florida, where this occurred, the neighborhood watch programs are overseen by the county. And in particular in Sanford, is in fact closely supervised, and all of the groups are registered with the National Sheriff's Association. So it's likely that, again, we don't know for sure because we don't know how well trained this particular individual was, but it is certainly likely that the Neighborhood Watch Association that Zimmerman was part of, given that they were registered, was at least had been provided a set of guidelines, and Zimmerman violated those. There's no question about it. And, you know, your question is the big what if. What would have happened
we
won't. There are people who say, well, therefore Trayvon Martin would have been alive, and that's very likely true. But we, to this day, don't know for sure what Trayvon Martin's motivations were. He's not there to defend himself, and I'm not going to cast aspersions on his motivations. But we don't know, and to assume that we know what was in Trayvon Martin's head any more than anyone else does is also overly simplistic in my mind. But you're right, no
and
question
then,
about it.
Yeah, and then as to the, you know, question of race and prejudice, and for myself, I mean, it's a hard question. You know, I really don't think that I'm a prejudicial person, but there are instances where I am careful. For instance, like living in Sanford, unfortunately, there was a large poor population, and we had people who were homeless and lived on the streets, and where we lived was in the downtown area. And on several occasions, you know, we would have people come up and ask for food. And, you know, I would, you know, go get John in the house because I didn't feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a woman single out, not single, but alone outside in front of my home. So I don't know. I wish we would get to the point as a nation, as a world of people, that we don't look at these things, that we don't look at color, what people are wearing. And I don't know if it's so much a cultural or societal, and maybe it is both, and maybe it is how we're brought up as children and the messages that our parents give us that we bring with us into adulthood, and then our personal experiences. You know, Kathleen had mentioned about if a woman was attacked and raped, you know, does she think of all men as bad? And she didn't know the answer to that. And sometimes women do feel that way. You know, if you're abused or something, you stereotype that into your personal situation. And for a while in the process of your healing and going on with your life, you know, there are times when you do have to, for your own protection, to get over things, to tell yourself that certain people or certain groups of people may not be safe for you. But that's something that, you know, in that kind of circumstance, that you, as you go on in your life and you go through your healing process, that you get over it. So.
Yeah, there's no question, I think, in my mind that people would be gun-shy, to use the unfortunate metaphor, to be in situations or around people who look or act like those with whom they've had bad experiences in the past. And I think that's just, to some degree, a fact. There's all these things that come together. You know, there's no question in my mind that we, as humans, recognize otherness. There's also no question in my mind that society teaches us how to react to that otherness. And to your point, you know, will we ever see a society that is willing to embrace it or recognize it without necessarily reacting negatively? You know, certainly the evidence isn't there. I mean, the evolutionarily, we're not that different, certainly, than we have been throughout history. And there's no reason to suspect that we're suddenly tomorrow going to be of a different nature and suddenly become, you know, sort of super aware of ourselves. I think it's an unfortunate reality. It doesn't mean, by the way, that that's a that's some sort of excuse for allowing us to continue to behave a certain way or for allowing us not to work on these things. You know, to DR's point earlier, these are things that he and I both agree need to be worked on, but how they're worked on, if they're worked on, I think, in the sense of pretending that we don't recognize otherness, I think that's futile. If we work on it from a societal point of view of how we react to that otherness, I think perhaps we can make some progress in some ways. So,
hopefully we can.
Hopefully we can. Thanks for calling in, Marcel. Say hello to John and tell him to. I will make sure that voiceover sounds a little bit better the next time I play it. It's the
all
first
right.
time I've heard it
you
over
guys
the air.
Both
it still
have
needs a little production work.
All right.
So
you have a good night.
Yes, thank you, Marcel. You too. Take care. So Eric, I haven't talked to you in a while. We, you know, sort of been you've sort of been listening, and you know, I don't want to completely let you off the hook. We've had quite a few thoughts here. And I'm wondering if this, you know, how you feel about what I've said, which is that I don't think we can really overcome our nature to recognize otherness, but perhaps we can work on how we react to it. Does that?
Yeah. Well, I would hope that the case would cause people to look inward and ask themselves about their own conduct. And that's a personal choice, whether you cross the street when you see an African-American walking down you know, the other way. It reflects on you, and it's probably going to hurt the person's feelings. And you have to ask yourself, okay, well, how important is it to me to not look like a racist and to not hurt people's feelings? That's not really what I'm focused on, though, here, because what I'm focused on, I want to prevent things like this from happening in the future. And so for that, I think we have to make decisions collectively about the laws that we have. And the Stand Your Ground law, obviously, is a very bad law. But we also have to deal with the ways in which people who are in law enforcement or whatever Neighborhood Watch is supposed to be or whatever George Zimmerman thought it was supposed to be, people who carry guns around and choose who to harass and who not to harass, there needs to be some guidelines that instruct them against racial profiling. And so that's one of the things that I would like to see come out of it. And what makes the case really interesting is that even though it doesn't necessarily, it's necessarily legal precedent, but it's a cultural precedent. And where it falls is that there are a lot of conservatives, and I talked to several today, they don't think racial profiling is a problem. One guy said, look, if you look at terrorism, well, I blame the Muslims. And I think if we want to stop terrorism, we've got to look at the Muslims. Okay? There are people who feel that way. And so when someone like me, although I didn't in this case, but because Annabelle was conducting the interview, but when someone says, well, look, you're trampling on a fellow American citizen's constitutional rights to equal protection under the law when you make policy or you support policy that either condones or requires, as North Carolina is now considering doing with regard to people who look like immigrants, further investigation or detainment of people based on their appearance, that's unconstitutional. And so when we say that to people who think that it's perfectly okay to assume that all black men are criminals and all Arab or Muslim people are terrorists, well, then they feel offended because they think that you're saying that they're racist or bigoted, and they're clearly not, because most terrorists are Muslims, so therefore most Muslims must be terrorists. And so it's about the kind of political will that we have to actually uphold our Constitution in the way that we practice law enforcement and or whatever the heck George Zimmerman thought he was doing.
Yeah, you excellent point, Eric. I couldn't agree more. And this is the conversation that seems to me very few people are having, is, you know, to go back to Marcel's point about the degree to which this is part of our culture, part of our society, the part of our culture that says, you know, anybody should be, you know, packing and should be protecting the homestead, and the part of our culture that says it's okay to profile them, whoever we decide they are at this particular point in time, to me it's not about it's not necessarily about race per se, but it is about a culture that wants to create an us and them and wants to create an environment of, you know, almost a false freedom under the guise of freedom and patriotism that says, you know, all, you know, every man for himself or every person for themselves. That's the real cultural issue to me that's behind all of this. And, you know, if you want to make the argument that this may be a watershed moment in that discussion, I would love to see this be a watershed moment in that discussion. I'm not really seeing it yet, though. I mean, you're talking about it. Annabelle's talking about it. Even I haven't been talking about it until you brought it up. It's just not the one. People are much more comfortable saying, well, you know, he was an African-American, and African-Americans are being targeted or profiled or whatever, when in fact, I think the issue is bigger than that. It's a society that basically wants to enculturate profiling, is pushing to enculturate profiling. And I wonder to the degree of, you know, what is the tenuous but possibly real relationship between what happened in Sanford and what happened on 9/11 in terms of the American psyche and the shift that it made. And that's a stretch probably, but maybe I'll write about it anyway. Let's go to a couple more callers. before I give you a chance to respond to that, and because you probably just ripped my argument apart, so I don't want to give you that opportunity. We'll go to 518 next, and then 808. You're on the Middle Ground, listening to the Middle Ground with Michael Charney and Eric Beiler. Area code 518, welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Michael. Welcome back. Joe Pomponi off in Albany, New York. How you been?
Hi, Joe, and thanks for the welcome, and thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I guess I'm one of the few that doesn't really view this as a racial case. I'm honest. I didn't follow the trial day by day. It, quite honestly, got a bit annoying. What we have, in my view, what I've seen all along, is the stand your ground law. If you put laws on the books, and it has nothing to do with pigmentation, okay, you have a law in the books that a person can literally take another life. By any means, forget gun. You can take a knife, a sledgehammer, kill someone. If there's no witnesses there, you claim self-defense. On the stand your ground laws, they let you walk. Right?
Let me just interrupt for a second, because and I'm no expert on this, but I understood it a little bit differently. So I would agree that the presence of a stand your ground law may create a feeling or a cultural hall pass, if you will, to do what Zimmerman did. But in this particular case, the defense was not stand your ground. Stand your ground was the argument for not indicting him in the first place. And the judge did talk about stand your ground as part of the juror instructions in terms of the way they made their decision. But the defense was not a self-defense based on stand your ground laws at all. It was purely self-defense.
So the
facts of the case and the rulings of the case were based on self-defense, not on stand your ground.
Yeah, but the stand your ground law gave him 6 weeks, okay? If you want to deal with the exact case, I didn't follow it day by day. It's not,
I agree with you. The stand your ground law gave him time under which and created social pressure for the indictment. But there was time where he was not being charged. There was noise. It may be even partly responsible for the media circus that came out of it. Certainly stand your ground laws was, again, right after, we're in the midst of gun control conversation, so it's a lot of noise around that. I would not argue with you that it was a factor in this case. Would it have happened, though? There are people who are saying it wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been stand your ground laws, and I'm not buying that. That I'm not buying, because the fact is neighborhood watches predate stand your ground laws. Neighborhood watches with people carrying exist in states where there are no stand your ground laws. And to say that this wouldn't have happened if Florida didn't have a stand your ground law, I think is a logical leap that we can't make. Maybe it's true and maybe it's not, but I don't think we can make the leap.
Okay, I would give you that. Then let me ask you this. One of the things they habitually brought up was the cry for help. Now, maybe I'm naive, but if I'm armed and I'm not a police officer, I have no identifying sign on me to say that I am armed, why didn't I hear a scream, "I am armed"? And that alone would stop me. All right? These are some of the things, but I'm not in Florida. The fact that he could have stayed in the car.
That's a big one for me.
If you're told to stay somewhere, if police tell me something. That's another thing about this racial thing. I have always been polite to police officers. I'm white, okay? Where I live, it's predominantly a white area. There are African-American families, and I got to admit, they're exceptional. The children are good. I see them on the street, yet I hear innuendos about it. But if I'm pulled over by a policeman, okay, I follow their instructions. They are the law and order. confront them. Anybody I've known, and I've known a couple of people that are white, that have mouthed off to them, they didn't like the consequences of what happened to them. So, you know, I have a hard way to go with racial. I know it's out there. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. But, you know, as far as the profiling and, you know, I'm looking at his stalking, you know, for whatever his reason was, all right? He shouldn't have been following him, all right? And if you were following him, he should have identified himself as Watch. I'd like to talk to you. You know.
Well, we don't know that he didn't, Joe. I mean, that's, I think up to that point I'm with you, but we start, when we start, and this gets back to the crux of where I started, is that, you know, the kinds of things that we say to ourselves and why we think what we think. What I'm hearing in your voice, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I may be making an assumption, is you're putting 51%+ of the blame here on Zimmerman. I'm not going to say all of it, but you seem to be leaning that way. Am I right in that?
Yes, but I'm basing
okay.
it on.
Okay. So and so in so believing that, it's not unusual for you to think about things, or for anyone to think about things like, you know, why didn't we hear him identify himself as Neighborhood Watch? Well, there could be a whole bunch of reasons why we didn't. It wasn't recorded. He didn't say it. He did say it, and it wasn't heard. I mean, there's a lot of things like that we'll never know. And it's interesting to me, the kinds of holes in various stories that people will try to pick at in order to sort of back up their inclination. A lot of these things bother me too, and I force myself to stay back. And I'm not saying I'm immune at all. A lot of times it's only because I'm writing about these things, or it's only because I'm preparing a radio show, that I force the level of self-awareness. I'm not sitting here and telling you I'm more self-aware than anyone else. In fact, I went through the same set of emotions and assumptions as everyone else over the course of this case. But when it came time and I said, well, I'm going to be getting on the radio to talk about this, I'm going to be blogging about this, I need to think seriously about what I'm assuming and what I'm not assuming, because that's kind of what I talk about. But I think we all do it. I think we all do it.
Maybe you can understand this. This law, the Stand Your Ground law, is in 25 states, okay? And how many times...
I think it's actually 18, but either way, it's a chunk of them.
Yeah. How many people out there, after all the publicity, after all, and this thing's not going to go away, all right, are going to get it in their heads that if I have a gun and I'm alone and it's dark or no one's around, I can do what I want based on how I feel? And, you know, are we going to be going through this again and again and again? Yeah, that's the thing that scares me. It's not a race. I don't envision white people going out after African-Americans. I don't envision African-Americans going after white people, but I envision people with problems, okay, that have no concept of self-control, okay, maybe going off the deep end. And this thing could open a can of worms. If there's anything about this that bothers me, it's that.
I wonder about that too, although I am encouraged by the fact that over the last couple of days we haven't seen the kinds of things that people were afraid of. By the way, I just checked. It's actually 24 states have unlimited stand your ground laws, so you were much closer than I was. Another 7 states have some limited version, for example, in your vehicle or at your place of business, but not just anywhere. And interestingly, Connecticut is one of those states. It's the only one in the Northeast. Well, Pennsylvania as well. But Connecticut is one of those states that has limited stand your ground as well. So you were right on that. But I do, you know, I do take to your last point, Joe, and then I want to move on to our next caller. I do take some – I'm encouraged by the fact that while there have been demonstrations about this verdict, without question, they have been, for the most part, peaceful and certainly a long way away from what some of the far right wing, some of the fear mongering that went on in the far right wing.
I won't argue with you on that.
Yeah. So that's good. But to your point, I think there is a lot yet to be played out here. I mentioned thanks for the call, Joe. I mentioned in my blog today that there was a website, not a website, it was a Facebook page called Kill Zimmerman. It was a closed group page with 95 members, like that, 95. And that's perhaps that's not a big number in Facebook terms, but the idea that 95 people in a closed group decided to join something called Kill Zimmerman was very disconcerting to me. You know, this guy's life, we kind of forget about it. This guy's life is over as he knows it. I mean, you know, it's just not going to be the same. And I have to believe, and here I'm making an assumption, I have to believe that he, when I say I have to believe it, I don't have to believe it because of fact. I just have to believe it as a human being. I hope that he, you know, is going to, you know, regrets this deeply and probably wonders himself how he ever got into this situation. And I imagine there's a dozen decisions he made he wishes he could take back. But, you know, it's not going to be pretty for him, certainly. I want to go to area code 808. 808 is our next caller in queue. We've been waiting quite a long time. Thank you so much for holding on. Area code 808, welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Anthony. How you doing? Calling from Hawaii.
Hi, Anthony, from Hawaii.
Yes.
Have you called before, or is this our very first call from Hawaii?
This is my first time calling.
You may be calling from the only place in America that is not desperately under a heat wave right now sweating like crazy.
Yes, it's mildly warm here. I'm enjoying it.
Mildly warm. We envy you, certainly.
Yes.
What's on your mind, Anthony?
Yeah, I've been listening to a couple callers, and on the verdict, real quick, I think the verdict was just. I think it was correct. In fact, I catch a lot of flack being a black male, and it just amazes me that even amongst family I talk to, the influence that has been surrounded around this case in terms of the verdict. I think basically what we're dealing with here is a difference in culture, because we can't forget or disexclude the racial component in this, between black culture, African-American culture, whatever, and Caucasian white culture or other cultures that aren't African-American. And when you're looking at the situation with Trayvon Martin,
explain that a little bit. What do you mean by the differences in culture? What do you see as those differences?
Well, the differences I see, especially growing up amongst, primarily African-American community, the attitudes towards authority, to me, vary. Because I've lived, I've worked, I've went to school in an all-white setting, and also in an all-black setting. And it, you know, not to put certain groups up on a pedestal, but it seems to me that blacks, African-Americans, didn't have a certain level of respect for authority as opposed to whites. And I think for myself, this played a lot in the Trayvon Martin case. People seem to forget that in this community, in Sanford, that there was a rash of robberies in this community. And unfortunately, they were predominantly African-American. Now, I think racial profiling is a term that has been hijacked for just ordinary common sense. If there's a certain group of people that I know that have been, hitting certain houses around the community, and they dress in a certain attire and all this stuff, and I happen to see one, in the case of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, acting rather suspiciously, then common sense, I believe you made this reference to a couple callers back about how making snap decisions, something that we've evolved, that you just look and say, okay, I, you know, all these things go to your mind. Okay, I know there's been a bunch of black guys who've been robbing, or predominantly a bunch of black guys have been robbing these places. Hmm, I see said person over there who may not be doing something illegal, you know. I think that's what George Zimmerman saw. I don't think he woke up wanting to kill a young black kid. I think it's just something he saw, and he acted on it, you know. And, you know, it's just crazy how I said that George Zimmerman, not George Zimmerman actually, but somebody with that mentality who has a someone who's concerned about that, because if you look inside the African-American community, you have this rampant no-snitch policy or whatever, where people can literally have someone shot blocks from their home, and when the police come up and knock on their door and ask for assistance, they don't know anything, they haven't seen anything, they shut the door, they shut the blinds, they don't want to be cooperative. So in contrast with George Zimmerman, who knew about robberies and decided to go out and actively, maybe, you know, did he go overboard? Perhaps. But at least he took the initiative to recognize a problem, go out, and maybe do something about it, where in the African-American community, that's, you know, it's a sweeping generalization, but I think I'm qualified to say it's pretty much non-existent. And that goes back about the difference in cultures dealing with authority, police, and having respect for authority. I'm here because I get on blogs, and a lot of African-American groups, blogs, saying, well, he didn't have to say anything to George Zimmerman. You know, who is he, you know? And that, to me, shows the breakdown, because that's not how I was raised. I was raised, especially as an adult, never mind being a police officer, a badge, gun, just respect for someone older than you. You make your, you know, whatever you're doing known. Hey, I'm going up the street. I'm just passing through. Going home to watch the All-Star game, as it was said Trayvon Martin was doing, and just keep it moving. And that's what people don't understand, that's what the case was about. The time Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman met. The car situation.
That's a really interesting point, you know, Anthony. Nobody has really brought up that point before. And it makes me wonder a little bit about the interests that might be served by having us spend so much time talking about race instead of, as I think Eric mentioned before, a culture or a set of laws or a community attitude that says, let's put a gun in a 29-year-old's hand and let them walk the neighborhood, and that that's a good thing somehow to be doing. Or let's create a culture in which it's okay for someone to make really, really poor judgment calls, really poor decisions. You know, it's interesting, and thank you for the call, Anthony. We're getting close to the end of the show, and I want to give a couple of other guests a chance to chime in. But very interesting point. Thank you for bringing it up. I appreciate it. And enjoy the wonderful weather. We're not having it here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, you know, it occurred to me, and, you know, I've seen it dozens of times, but it never really sunk in that George Zimmerman is 29 years old. And I assume 28 when this occurred, right? 29 was, you know, he's 29 now. And I think of my own kid at 28 or 29. I never viewed him as sort of a really fully formed adult to the point where, you know, all of those sort of judgments and decisions were going to be rock solid. And I'm really curious. I want to go back to you, Eric, and then I was hoping to maybe grab one more caller. But I'm curious what you think about Anthony's comment and how it dovetails a little bit with what you said, is that we basically, you know, this may let me a lot less about race than it is about a culture that says, hey, let's take a 28-year-old kid and put a gun in his pocket and have him walk the neighborhood, and that's what we want our society to be. What are your thoughts, Eric? Are you with us, sir?
I agree with Anthony that the case that was put before the jury was about the moment that the gun was fired and whether a self-defense argument can be made within a reasonable doubt to prevent a conviction. And I think that with that case before them, that the jury made the right decision. And I say that having watched about maybe half an hour's worth of CNN coverage. I didn't believe that the person screaming was Trayvon. I thought that his mother and father testified that way because they believed that was the way to get justice for their son. That was just what came across to me. And I also heard the testimony of a man who had tried to teach George Zimmerman how to fight and said that basically he was a 1 on a scale of 10 and that he, you know, he was overmatched. And I also heard another person testify. He was kind of a witness. And what he said seemed to indicate that it's true that it was Zimmerman who was getting his butt kicked at the moment that the gun went off. So, you know, and I think Anthony and, you know, we should bring Diari on again because he's also African-American. He didn't really say how he felt about the verdict itself. But you're
I think Diari had to drop off, unfortunately.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Yeah.
But Anthony is right that, what the jury received in their sequestered state, and who knows why the judge decided some things were admissible and other things were not, that, you know, justice was, the right verdict. Reasonable doubt protects people from, I think, what would have happened if he was convicted. It protects people from being the victim of a cultural phenomenon and basically the verdict being influenced by history and culture and the tragedy of slavery and Jim Crow and white supremacy and all of that. So, you know.
Interesting. Of course, that puts us in the classic no-win conundrum, which is that you can't, it's hard to argue against that when people want to argue for it, because by arguing against it, you're just being told you're denying it.
I'll share with you a tidbit. I presented this question to a young college student who actually looks a lot like Trayvon. His name is Tyler, and he's part of the Moral Monday movement. And I presented a self-defense argument, and he said, well, it's hard to say it's self-defense when Zimmerman is the one who pursued Trayvon with a gun and initiated the contact. So I can understand how people don't want to believe it was self-defense, but my view is that our history and the struggle that we still must face to afford people of color in this country equal justice under the law, that was influencing the way people hoped that this verdict would come out. Because like Joe said, it's about what happens in the future. And if the cultural ethos of this country slips back toward justice for all actually excludes black people, well, that could mean that we're going to have more cases like this that actually do involve race. And not to mention, you know, as you saw in the video that I did with Joshua Vincent, he's saying, how can I explain to my nephews that you aren't really free? You were happy about Barack Obama becoming president when you were 4. Now you're 9. And when you're 16, you won't have the same rights as another 16-year-old who doesn't happen to be black because you look like a criminal to most people. I mean, I think that's what we really have to deal with.
I think most people is a bit of a stretch there, but I do get your point. And it wasn't. But by the way, those of you who haven't seen that video, it's a very, very touching video. It's up on the Coffee Party website. It's also, I've got a link to it from my blog as well, back to it. It's just a few minutes, but it's a very powerful few minutes. One man's reaction about how he's going to talk to his son. But I think you also posted it on Facebook as well. We've got time for just one more caller. We have area code 404 has been waiting a bit to get in. Area code 404, welcome to the Middle Ground. I'm going to ask you to make it real quick because we've just got a couple minutes left. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Bobby Rodrigo, Michael, nice to hear you back on the Middle Ground.
Oh, hi, Bobby. How are you? Thank you so much for the kind words.
I'm very good.
What's on your mind? Real quick. Got 2 minutes.
I thought the charge should have been manslaughter and not second-degree murder. I think that the duplicity, Zimmerman was wrong in that he initiated what was going to transpire, but I certainly believe he had the right to defend himself when he thought that he was under duress. I think that the race situation in our country, though still exists without question, I think that this was used to do exactly what some of the well-thought-out opinions that have been given, Eric's recently in the call from Hawaii, Anthony, right before that, Michael, yours, some very well-thought-out comments this evening, without a doubt, nothing rash, which is nice. I will say
yes.
That from the standpoint of murder in this country and racial murder, that 90% of the black murders that happen in this country are perpetrated by blacks, and 83% of the white murders that happen in this country are perpetrated by whites. The race murders, per se, are more of an anomaly than a natural occurrence. And when incidents like this are brought forward, to me, there's always an agenda, some good, some bad, like anything else, with our 1% media. And a very good show tonight, guys, and I'll get out your way.
Thanks very much, Bobby. I appreciate the call. You know, really good point. And I sort of started the show here, and Bobby mentioned it sort of. It's kind of a good way to wrap up. People made decisions on selling us this story, and I'm not suggesting that. I'm not saying by suggesting that it wasn't an important story, and it may not have the sort of watershed or cultural moments that Eric certainly, that you have been talking about. But there are lots and lots of tragic stories. It's unfortunate to say, but there are probably hundreds per day. And Bobby's right, when there's one that we know or that the media knows, will trigger the kind of emotional response that will get us to sit there long enough in the commercials to see the Tide commercial or the Crest commercial, then they're going to put that one on the air and they're going to fire us up about it to keep our eyes on the screen. And we're not necessarily going to see the same kinds of cases. We see celebrity cases. I remember as a kid, Andy Williams' ex-wife, Claudine Longet, and the skier, those big famous profile cases and celebrity cases and race-related cases, even if they're not fundamentally about race, will be made that way so that we kind of eat them up. So I think the only thing we know for sure, in my mind, is that there will be more of these and that they will continue to be sold to us and we will continue to eat them up, unfortunately, as a society. In the meantime, I certainly hope that there are large communities of thoughtful people who will be working to try to change the way people view these kinds of things, that will continue to create environments for more rational conversation around them. And that's an uphill struggle as well against, as Bobby pointed out, the 1% media. But we're here hopefully to be part of that for everyone. I want to thank everyone for listening tonight. Eric, as always, you've been a great go-host. You get back in your car and on to wherever your next town is. Thank you, everyone, for listening, all of our callers for calling in. And we will see you next week on The Middle Ground.
Our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow The Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.